Welcome back to the program. You know, there are certain names, certain brands that have not only become household names in the realm of entertainment, but have profoundly reshaped the entertainment landscape. HBO in 1972 changed the business of movies. MTV in 1982 forever changed the music business. In September of 1979, ESPN would begin to rewrite the way that fans consume sports and reshape the business of sports. This 30-year story is detailed in a new book, a kind of company biography, by our guest, Dr. Anthony Smith. He's the co-founder and managing director of Leadership Research Institute. It's one of the leading management consulting firms in the world, specializing in leadership development and assessment. He's served an enviable list of clients, including American Express, the National Football League, Coca-Cola, and many others. He's the author of a new book entitled ESPN, The Company, The Story and Lessons Behind the Most Fanatical Brand in Sports. Anthony Smith, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, it's great to be here, Jeff. Thank you.
Great to have you here. Talk first about the founding of ESPN back literally 30 years ago this week by a group of guys that just were sports fans, really.
Well, that's right. You know, Bill Rasmussen and his son basically had this idea that there's got to be other people other than themselves who love sports as much as they do. And I guess in trying to be realist, they said, well, you know, we need to be able to air at least our local games because we know enough fans around here in Connecticut that would love to see a few Whalers games, would love to see a few UConn games. So he sought out to find some distribution elements to be able to air some of the local games, and ultimately found, talk about happy accidents, he found out that to get a transponder would cost him as much to reserve a few hours as it would be to reserve it for 24 hours a day, and thus was kind of the initial, you know, 24-hour sports programming network.
And their notion about what they could possibly put on to fill all that time. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, the running joke was when they would call colleges or they would call any sports leagues, they would say, look, we're just asking to see if you guys had any tapes of any of the games floating around. We'd love to put them on air. And then the question was, well, what kind of tapes are you looking for? And they said long ones. All they wanted was enough content to fill the space, again, going back to the fact that they had 24 hours of sports programming to fill. But as the story goes, because they certainly didn't have the money to buy the rights to some of the big ball and stick games, they had slow pitch softball, they had Australian rules football on, mud wrestling, you name it, anything that even reflected sports or competition, they would put it on their air.
And talk about where the initial money came from to get this thing launched.
Well, he had a few initial investors that, I guess, gave him enough hope. But, you know, the big infusion of cash that really made this thing viable, at least for the short term, came from an unlikely source, and that was Getty Oil. Getty Oil at the time was a very profitable, obviously, oil company that they had a division that looked for alternative, or I should say non-core business investments. And a guy by the name of Stu Eavy, who was in charge of that division of Getty, who also happened to be a sports fanatic, heard about this little company up in Bristol, Connecticut. And based on his research and given the fact that Rasmussen was able to seize the a few of these RCA transponders and be able to air 24 hours of sports a day, Stu Eavy thought it was going to be a good investment, so basically provided the first $10 million in venture capital to Rasmussen and his team.
And Getty at the time really was showing a lot of foresight because this wasn't the only entertainment-related property they were investing in. They had already begun to have a small presence in Los Angeles and were looking for other entertainment ventures.
That's exactly right. And again, I think the reason that they really focused in, because again, it was high risk at the time, this little startup up in Bristol, Connecticut, because as you said, they were loaded with cash and they could have gone after a number of, be it cable entities or even, you know, parts of some of the big established networks, had it not been for the sports fanaticism of Stu Eavy, probably would have never heard of ESPN in this current time.
In addition to the Rasmussens, the father and son team, Bill and Scott, who founded it, they brought in a guy named Chet Simmons to be president of it initially. Talk about him.
Yeah, Chet Simmons was, one of those guys that, you know, when you talk about the folklore of ESPN, He was one of those guys who was a, you know, veteran operator, really understood the business. And aside from, you know, guys who just love sports or guys who had money behind them, he was a guy who really, I think, instilled kind of the first systems and real kind of organization to the company and instilled some real discipline, which I think is to this day a part of the DNA that a lot of people don't know about ESPN. They are a very disciplined, very well-run company, and he certainly gets a lot of accolades for being, you know, one of the first who really got certainly the leadership within ESPN to really think like a business, not just you know, a crazy frat house where they were going to go out and find game tapes to show to other sports fanatics.
There really was something that was set from the very beginning, from this time that you're talking about, that inculcated a number of things into the culture of the company that still is with it to this day, 30 years later.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, I don't know if ESPN appreciates it, but I call it organizational schizophrenia, where at one point they took things lightly because even if the production quality wasn't what everybody would have liked it to be, they would laugh it off and say, well, you know, what the hell, nobody's watching anyway, so even though we missed this cue or the production was poor on that, they would laugh it off. But yet in negotiations, and yet when they were after, you know, negotiating with some of the big leagues, they also had a mindset that they belonged there as much as any other major network. And one of the chapters in the book is think like an incumbent, but act like a challenger. And so when they needed to be, they had this mindset that they belonged there. They knew sports as well as anybody. They were gonna air sports and produce sports as well as anybody. But yet in the background, when they needed that release valve, they would kind of laugh it off and, you know, kind of realize they were still the small little company. And I see that same kind of mindset even in great athletes. I mean, I think Tiger Woods, when he first hit the PGA Tour, he didn't sit there and go, wow, I'm really amazed that I finally made the tour. When he, you know, his first tournament, he had the mindset that he was there to win, not that he was lucky to be there.
Talk a little bit about the emergence of SportsCenter as the powerhouse that it would become.
Well, obviously, SportsCenter is critical. It was critical to ESPN way back when they didn't have a lot of products. So it was actually the first product they developed. And again, I think it was a germ of an idea that you know, continued to be fostered and nurtured over the years. Again, going back to the fact that they didn't have a lot of money to buy the rights to a lot of the big games. They thought, well, you know what, we're going to have to start creating our own game, and thus came about, you know, X Games and outdoor games. But they also said, we need a product that we ultimately own, and they created SportsCenter, and that was going to be the place where they were going to discuss and debate and highlight and analyze sports like no other. As we know, at that time, I mean, yes, there was Wide World of Sports, but if you think about even local sports, the way it was covered, as I mentioned in the book, it really was a 4 or 5 minute spot between the weather and the news.
Uh-huh. This notion of long form coverage of sports, of really putting on full games, full events, talk a little bit about how that emerged as not just something to fill time, but really a viable alternative, a viable way to broadcast sports.
Yeah, ESPN's mantra is they exist for the sole purpose of serving fans. And this goes back to the notion that when they would hire people, and as they were building ESPN, they realized they needed sports fanatics. Because if they were going to serve fans, they needed, you know, the most talented people who had the ability to serve sports fans are going to be sports fans. You're in news, Jeff. If you want somebody who's great with news, you actually want a news junkie. And ESPN sought out to find sports junkies to either in front of the camera or in back of the camera in the finance office, whatever. And I think they realized, because of their love of sports, that seeing highlights was just not enough, that there was enough interest there that if you're a football fan, if you're a slow-pitch softball fan, if you're just a fan of sports, you would certainly have the appetite to watch games in its entirety. And as you said, it certainly transcended the point of just trying to, you know, find content to fill airtime. it really was, I think, designed and kind of embraced that, you know, sports fans really do have an appetite. And, you know, I think a lot of business can learn from ESPN that they certainly provided a service to the underserved. They realized that there was this appetite.
One of the things that they realized very early on, and it continued in the culture of the company as you talk about it, is that sports also was entertainment, and they never really lost sight of that fact.
Right, and that's where they, if you look at some of the you know, the famous sportscasters, I don't care if it's Berman or Stuart Scott, you see this kind of edginess where, again, they take sports very seriously, but then, again, going back to the schizophrenic notion, they also realize it is entertainment, so they make jokes about it. You know, aside from just treating it as a game, I think they transcended the game, and they realized there was even an appetite of kind of the periphery of sports. And you know, early on, it's probably what led them to negotiating with the NFL to get this NFL draft. There were parts of sports that were never even covered, and people thought that nobody would even be interested in other aspects of the game, and thus even the entertainment value of it. And they went after it, and obviously they found a sweet spot and realized that there certainly is a fan base for that, and they do it as well as anybody.
Talk a little bit about how what ESPN was doing was starting to influence what the networks were doing, how other television networks covered sports.
Well, I think because of their edginess, I'll call it, there was a certain youth spirit, and those of us who have done any work in media realize that, you know, that target audience is that young demographic, that 18 to 24. And I think because that was pretty much the demo who was creating and running ESPN at the time, they really did mirror their target audience. And again, going back to what you just said, there was a certain flair, a certain edginess as to how they covered sports, which I think certainly resonated with their key demographic. You know, we certainly know of some of the production elements now, from putting a camera on a cable above a football game, or putting a camera on a 12-meter yacht during the America's Cup race. They just really did think out of the box and thought, if I were a real fan, what would I want to see that I'm not being able to, you know, to see now when I watch a game on some of the big networks? So from, you know, camera angles to how the, you know, commentary on sports to the kinds of questions that were asked of athletes, I think they really did set the standard where, you know, all of a sudden the big networks looked and said, oh, my gosh, they're really starting to chip away at our market share. And why is it? Because they're doing sports like no other, and they, you know, I think that's literally probably 6-7 years after launch, the network started noticing that they were doing something pretty special.
I want to talk a little bit about that edginess that you've referred to a couple of times, and one of the ways in which that edginess manifested itself is in so many of the personalities that were part of ESPN, personalities that seemed to constantly be involved in one controversy or another.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know who you had in mind. You think of the Rush Limbaughs or whatever. Again, it's thinking out of the box, taking risks with individuals as well as how they covered sports. Even if you think of, you know, Playmakers, which was, you know, part of their original entertainment group, where they thought, you know, we're really going to start creating shows and original entertainment that certainly has a theme of sports, which may be a little bit edgy, but that's what our fans expect. And I think one of the big challenges ESPN realized they had is that sometimes there is controversy and there is conflict when you're trying to serve fans, but yet one of your key partners are a lot of the big sports leagues. And so if you look at what happened with Playmakers, certainly that one of their key partners is the NFL. When Tagliabue, at the time he was the commissioner of the NFL, realized that, hey, this really doesn't shine a positive light and some of it may be fictitious, you know, they certainly reached out to ESPN and said, look, we want to be partners with you guys. We realize part of your culture and part of your personality is to do some edgy things, but we think you've crossed the line. And there was some pretty heavy negotiations that went on, but I think ultimately that became a compromise where ESPN said, we've got to serve fans, and even though it was a critically acclaimed show, you know, they realized that they needed to have a long-term relationship with the NFL. So it was that constant balance of we want to be edgy to serve fans, but yet we also realize we have other constituents that we have to work with. And like everything in life, that, you know, if we just err on the side of doing anything the fan wants, even though it may violate some of our principles working with some of our other key partners, that's not what's good. That's ultimately not going to be good for the fan in the long term.
As many athletes and certain aspects of various sports entered controversy from time to time, talk about the balance that ESPN had to walk. On the one hand, covering these events as essentially a sports news organization, and at the same time, because of those relationships with the various leagues, also balancing their concern for the image of the league itself.
Yeah, and as a media person, Jeff, you know it's the tightrope that, you know, any journalist has to walk as well, of, you know, reporting the news and commenting on the news and somehow trying to honor whatever principles of whatever media company that you may be with. It's a tough one. I guess my only comment there is, even though they realized they had key partners, and now even being owned by Disney, Disney has a certain culture, a certain principle, a certain ethic about them that ESPN has to be sensitive to as their parent. But first and foremost, I think when ESPN looks at any event, any athlete, any bit of news, they look at it from the fans' perspective. And ultimately, and I'm down here in San Diego, and we've got a lot of news going on with Sean Merriman right now. And, you know, there's a lot of tabloid journalism going on about that because it's a hot story. I think ESPN's perspective is, well, you know, sports fans are first and foremost lovers of sport. And they take the position that, you know, until proven guilty, we're going to assume some innocence, particularly in the athletes, again, unless the evidence is so overwhelming, that we're going to certainly share the news. Our fans want information, and until we think that, I think they operate with the basic jurisprudence perspective that you really are innocent until proven guilty, and the burden of proof is on those who are accusing any athlete or any team of violating anything. So, you know, it sounds pretty fundamental, but they really do look at it from a fan's perspective. Look, we realize you guys want information, but you know, even though we can make news and really be opinionated and take the tabloid side of it all, we're going to continually monitor the situation and present the facts as they are, and then once a judgment's been made, then we'll comment on that judgment.
And of course, this balance has been going on right up to the present, and all the controversy that ESPN got surrounding the Ben Roethlisberger sexual assault case.
That's right, you know, that is a tough one because I was just up at the ESPYs, and I think ESPN looks at a lot of the athletes as a constituency, and they want a great relationship with the athletes. And again, first and foremost, they are sports fans. I think even, you know, that's what's in their mindset, even at the key levels and in the corner offices. So, you know, they look at athletes as, look, we want to honor you, but we are part of a society that also has principles. And again, we'll give you the benefit of the doubt. We'll honor our relationships, but once something's been violated, and it goes back to the Michael Vick stuff and everything else, that we'll take the perspective as a sports fan, and if indeed, you know, there's been any major violations, we'll be the first one, because I think even sports fans get offended when somebody really tarnishes a certain sport or even, you know, sports at a macro level.
One of the things that you talk about in the book is how ESPN has managed to have the right leadership at the right time. Talk a little bit about that, and people like Steve Borenstein and George Bodenheimer, who currently lead ESPN.
Yeah, well, you know, my background is the area of leadership. I taught leadership for years at the university level, and then I started doing consulting 5 years ago. As a student of leadership, what I have seen most in large Fortune 500 companies is that unless a company has gone down the tubes, the board, shareholders, even, you know, search committees, essentially, when they're thinking about succession and replacing a leader, they try to find somebody similar to the leader who has successfully led that organization up to that current point of transition. What amazed me about ESPN is that there was And it really does, I think it's a testament to the actual leaders, which has now become part of the culture of ESPN, is that each leader along the way realized that because of the rapid growth of this entity, that what got them there at that point in terms of leadership style, leadership approach, strategy, etc., may not be the same form of leadership that's going to get them to the next level. One of my old consulting partners, Marshall Goldsmith, wrote a book called What Got You Here Won't Get You There. That always seemed to be in the blood of the leadership at ESPN. So if you look at Roger Werner, who was a bright, brilliant, intellectual ex-McKinsey consultant who did a study on revenue models for ESPN, and Getty realized here was a bright guy who would be great for to run ESPN at the time in the mid to late 80s, hired Roger Werner. Roger Werner, once he got kind of the operational and got the distribution and business models in place, he realized that what was going to take ESPN to the next level is a brilliant programmer. And thank God they found Steve Bornstein. And, in the industry, many would say that there was no better programmer than a Steve Bornstein. And there was a heavy emphasis and brilliance when it came to programming. And, that I work with Steve probably longer than I have any other leader at ESPN, and I still serve them, that when Steve was thinking about a successor when he was running ABC, the first person he thought of was George Bodenheimer, even though he certainly did his due diligence and thought through some of the other candidates. And if you know both personalities, you'll know that George Bodenheimer is a 180 from the kind of leader that Steve is, just in terms of approach. I mean, they both have the same ethic. They both love sports. They both honor and cherish the institution of ESPN, but their approaches are just different. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty rare, to be able to pick somebody who doesn't look like the same person staring you back in the mirror.
And what is the focus of ESPN today? Certainly you talk a lot about expanding the ESPN brand. Beyond that, what are the risks of the future? What is the company looking towards?
Well, they will certainly, there's a focus on not just expanding the brand nationally and looking for more sports or more products and more entities to slap those four letters on. They're certainly looking to expand globally. And Russell Wolf, who is the EVP of International, is doing a great job of getting the ESPN name out there around the world. But we all know what's happening from a technological standpoint, and I think what they're really looking at is to make sure that they're creating production of sports that can be watched and listened to on any platform. They were, I think, one of the pioneers when it came to covering sports in HD. I remember at a 98 Super Bowl when we were in the ESPN box at San Diego Stadium, they had an HD TV there. It was, extremely expensive, and certainly from the camera and production levels to do that, but they realized that's what fans wanted. Fans wanted to watch sports in high def, and they realized that, they probably want to watch sports in 3D, and they want to be able to catch sports on their phones or iPods, whatever. So they're certainly looking at the technological implications. And as much as they, like any business, wants to continue to expand the brand, they're also very protective of the brand, which I certainly applaud them for.
Mm-hmm. Talk about how ESPN integrated with ABC and how well that worked.
Which is, I think, another lesson as a student of organizations. I can tell you that statistically speaking, 60-70% of all mergers and acquisitions fail, not because they didn't make strategic sense, but they somehow clashed from a cultural standpoint. And ABC Cap City certainly had a different cultural feel to it than ESPN. I think what they realized, and this is where success comes in, is when ABC was looking at ESPN, they realized that was a different culture. It was a different mindset, and even though it was media and even though it was sports, there was something different about that. And to ABC's credit, Murphy and Burke, the guys who were running ABC at the time, realized that it was in their best interest to essentially let ESPN, continue to do what it was doing at the time. And if anything, they basically supported them and supplied them with some of the resources that allowed them to expand. And I think Disney was the same way. And I don't think I'm speaking out of school, but I think when Disney first acquired ABC and thus they acquired ESPN, you know, and Eisner was running Disney at the time. If you've ever studied Michael Eisner, you know that he has a point of view about things, and you know, he certainly shared some of his points of views. But to the credit of Eisner and to the credit of Bornstein and Bodenheimer, they said, look, we think we've got it, and until we really, you know, trip up and devalue this institution, you know, we're going to ask you to leave us alone. And the numbers were there, and the success was there. And again, to everybody's credit, they essentially let ESPN continue to do what it was doing, but yet also providing some major resources to allow them to do some things that they couldn't have done on their own.
Is there ever the concern that there could be an oversaturation of sports, in part because of all the different opportunities and platforms that ESPN currently has?
That's a great question, Jeff. And, you know, personally, I would say I think you always have to worry about oversaturation. When Bornstein first took over ABC, he was very concerned about the oversaturation of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And it was being shown four or five nights a week, and it's a different question than you said, but he realized there is, to keep a little bit of want and anticipation and mystique to things, you really have to kind of monitor that saturation point. But I think because there's so much fragmentation in media today that it really is in the consumer's hand, that if they feel as though they're being saturated, they're, you know, they've got so many opportunities to you know, engage in any other form of media, any other form of entertainment or news, whatever. So the fact that they're just there as an option, I think, will kind of protect them. But it's an insightful question. I can tell you that it's certainly on the minds of the leadership at ESPN.
Talk a little bit about ESPN's relationship now and over the years, the evolution of its relationship with the various leagues, with the NBA, the NFL, and with Major League Baseball.
Well, you know, one of the reasons that I think George Bodenheimer has been such an effective leader is he has great relationships with the commissioners of the leagues. And rather than having an adversary or even a neutral, mediocre relationship, I think George really realized that that ESPN needs to think of the sports leagues as their partners. And, you know, the fact that everybody wants to entertain sports fans, if, again, it's kind of cliche and it sounds pretty simplistic, that if they can work together as a partnership, it's going to be, you know, it's certainly in the best interest of everybody, of all the shareholders involved in both entities, but more importantly, it's the right thing for the sports fan. And I can tell you, and it's certainly a theme throughout the book, is that it's an astonishingly simple principle that if you look at the world through the eyes of a sports fan, because that is your core constituency as to who you're trying to serve, that will guide a lot of decisions, even the kinds of decisions and the relationships you have with all your constituents. And there's nobody who realizes that, I think, greater than current president right now, and that's George Bodenheimer.
Which sort of leads to the final point, that one of the things in the culture of ESPN is about not only sports but also having fun in general.
Yeah, that's so true. And again, it's emblematic of the nature of sports, the nature of ESPN. But ESPN has become so large and such a powerful force, and you know, to this day, I don't know, you know, I've spent a lot of time on Wall Street and working with investment banks where people put in crazy hours. People put in crazy hours at ESPN. Part of it is because they love it so much they probably forget that they've been at their desk or, you know, behind a camera for 10 or 12 or 14 hours. And again, it goes back to, I think, where George has really influenced the culture, where, you know, because of the demographics of the employees of ESPN have changed. They're no longer 17-year-old kids who are running camera crews, but they have families and they've got kids and their life has become more diversified. George is very serious about making sure that people do have a work-life balance, that they do have some elements of fun, and he, you know, encourages that, as I state in the book, and it's very accurate. When George will be in a cafeteria, and I've been in lots of cafeterias and lots of restaurants with him, that when he sees an employee, he doesn't say, hey, you know, how's the negotiations going with the MBA? His first question is, hey, John, how you doing? You having fun? And he's serious about that question, and you know, he's really got his ear to the pulse of the employees at ESPN, and he realizes that, you know, having fun is serious business at ESPN.
Anthony Smith, the book is ESPN, The Company, The Story and Lessons Behind the Most Fanatical Brand in Sports. It's just published by Wiley. Anthony, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Jeff. And if I could just say one word, I just want people to know, too, that all the proceeds, all my proceeds from the book are going to the V Foundation for Cancer Research. And your followers up there in Napa realize we have a big event up there. So I'm very proud that ESPN is associated with the V, and all my proceeds are going to this this foundation so we can find a cure for this disease.
Well, that's great. Anthony Smith, the book ESPN, The Company. Anthony, once again, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Jeff.